on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Today, one farmer using a unique approach to finding workers.
It's like people have just evaporated. In every industry, transport, livestock, yeah, farming in general, building, or we're trying to build a house. So, but yeah, I think if you want the job, if someone wants the right job and you can attract the right person, then it shouldn't be that hard to keep them.
Yeah, the chooks and cows keeping one farming couple very busy.
We started off with 350 layers 11 years ago, and now we have 3,000. And it's, yeah, we haven't looked back at that. And 4 years ago, we started our own herd of cows, and we've just been grading up from dairy cross animals to hoping to get to a more straighter line of Speckle Park breeding cows.
Yeah, we'll pay a visit to one Northwest Tasmanian farm coming up later in the program. And the job of looking for farm workers, that story shortly. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Tuesday, where the task of finding workers for the farm has seen two peak farming bodies in the state join forces to tackle that very issue. Also today, the same job, same pay campaign, what it could mean for the agriculture sector. Plus, a check on the weather and your thoughts on any issues via the text line. That number is 0438 922936. 0438 922936 is that number. First up, some breaking news from the dairy industry. And one of the big milk companies has revised its opening milk price upwards after announcing the opening price of $8.65 per kilo of milk solids only last week. Fonterra has decided to increase the offer to farmers by 35 cents. The new opening price for the season from July 1 will be $9 per kilo of milk solids. The new season opening price surpasses the Bega price offer of $8.80 and the Saputo price of $8.90 for Tasmanian dairy farms. Well, with the end of the spell of three La Niña years in a row, the overall value of the agriculture sector is set to contract by 14% in the next financial year due to drier than normal conditions. Executive Director of ABARES, Dr. Jared Greenville, says the reduction is expected. He spoke to Michael Condon.
That's right. We're looking at, I guess, coming down from what has been really three kind of exceptional years in terms of our climate, but also in terms of international prices for producers, which has seen some of the, you know, the highest levels of farm production and farm value that we've ever seen in this country. And we're expecting the climate, well, the Bureau of Met is expecting the climate to start to dry out a little bit. But given our starting position, we're expecting things to be still pretty solid for overall. And the value of farm production is expected to be around $78 billion, which is third highest on record, but it is down from, you know, the record that we hit of close to $92 billion last year.
So is it all weather-driven, or are we seeing some commodity prices come off a bit too?
It's both. So a large part is weather driving down some of our production of our winter crops, but we're also expecting prices to fall back from peaks that we saw over the last couple of years with, you know, a range of factors, including the war in Ukraine. But also when we were having good seasons, there were really some poor seasons in other parts of the globe, which restricted supply and then forced up prices. So we had all this going on at the same time, and we're starting to see that starting to drop out now. So with some lower prices and lower production, particularly in the cropping side, that will drive some of that fall. For livestock, we're expecting production to actually go up a little bit as a bit of a dividend from the herd and flock rebuilding that we've seen over the last few years, but prices are starting to moderate. So those two things really cancel out.
So, yeah, prices of livestock have dropped by about half from where they were, but they're still, people still say, oh, you know, it's they're still at sort of reasonable levels. It's just that big drop has people alarmed.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So they're still at reasonable levels. And when we look at, you know, our prices on, you know, our export side, that, you know, livestock prices are still looking solid compared to what we've seen over the past few years. And so they're still reasonable, but they've just certainly fallen back. And particularly as the demand for restocking has started to ebb away, and producers are looking at the same information that we're looking at in terms of what the Bureau of Met's putting out and expectations of dry conditions, and thinking about, you know, shifting from a restocking phase to a little bit of a, I guess, increased production and reducing some of the load on their land.
Well, last year, not everyone had bumper years, and we had terrible flood damage in a lot of grain-growing regions and pasture damage and things like that. So, you know, they might have been hoping for a good year this year, and now it's turned dry. Is it too much to be too worried about an El Nino year?
Yeah, so there's, I guess, a bit mixed at this point in time. So you're right that certainly some areas, you know, didn't get the dividends last year that we saw, you know, particularly, you know, in Western Australia where we had an exceptional season, areas on the eastern seaboard where we saw some crop area losses in New South Wales and Victoria, and also a bit of a slow, boggy start in Queensland, which limited plantings. We've got some mixed areas, you know, some areas in southern New South Wales and into, you know, southern Victoria are looking fairly good at the moment, with solid soil moisture and a good start to the season. In other areas, it's looking a little bit more, I guess, you know, on edge, in the sense that we've not started in the best position, and it'll be really dependent on how the rainfall goes out in the season. There is always the uncertainty as to when the timing of some of these drier conditions are expected to come, and I know that there's across parts of the country receiving some rainfall this week. So, you know, there is optimism in certain areas that we could, you know, still come through with a fairly good crop, but our expectations, I guess, at the national level is factoring in, you know, a shift to a drier sequence. And so, you know, it's starting to play a role, not overall, you know, I guess it was still expecting the sixth largest crop on record. So it's still a fairly solid result.
And you think that world commodity prices are likely to come back a bit, do you? Is that one of the forecasts too you're looking at?
Yeah, certainly. So world commodity prices across both our kind of crop and livestock products we're expecting to come back. So part of that's increased production for crops in other areas of the world. So, as you know, the US in particular has been really kind of hit hard with dry conditions, and US wheat has really been in short supply. But we're seeing at the moment, you know, some record production coming out of Russia, which is one of the largest, you know, grains producers in the world.
Europe's doing okay too?
Yeah, Europe's doing okay. We're seeing a rebound in canola in Canada. So all those kind of supply side pressures are starting to ease off, which we'll see some of the prices fall back. We're also seeing, I guess, you know, an increase in supply of livestock products, particularly from Australia, and in terms of global markets, and that will put a little bit of a pressure on prices as they come down. But when we look, you know, I guess over the last 10 years of like where prices have gone, and it's really been an upward trend the entire period. So even though they're correcting a little bit, they're still looking okay.
Dr. Jared Greenville, Executive Director of ABARES, talking there to Michael Condon about a predicted reduction of 14% in the value of agriculture sector in Australia for the next financial year. A little bit of rain about, and some oil on the road on the Brooker Highway heading from Hobart out towards Brighton. Quite a fair bit of oil on the road, and there's plenty of traffic problems, so avoid the Brooker Highway if you're heading out of Hobart. Police are telling us there's quite a few accidents and slippery conditions there along the Brooker, so take an alternative route if you can. Coming up, two peak bodies of Tasmanian agriculture join forces to fight the labour shortage.
This June, get ready for a huge winter of cricket.
One of the most dramatic mornings Test cricket you'll ever see.
The Women's Ashes.
Beaumont is struck on the pad and Perry's appealing and she's got another one.
And a rivalry bigger than the game itself. The Ashes.
Goes in and bowls to Smith, who works it away. There it is. 200. And you'll take another for luck as well.
The Ashes.
On ABC Sport Digital and the ABC Listen app. Just look for the red cricket button.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Two of Tasmania's peak farming organisations are joining forces to try and combat the labour shortage in the farm sector. Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association and the Primary Employers Tasmania will work closer together to present a united voice for the farm sector. Fiona Breen spoke to the presidents of both organisations, Ian Saw and Ben Grubb.
having a stronger alliance and working relationship with Tas Farmers and Graziers Association. Tasmanian agriculture needs a stronger united voice on probably the most important issue facing agriculture in Tassie at the moment, and that's labour, workforce and employment issues. We have an expert advisor here for everyone involved in agriculture to give them advice. We're aligning ourselves with TFGA, realigning ourselves, I guess you could say, after 20 years of being out on our own and using the advocacy and lobbying as well as office and other resources of TFGA to give a stronger voice for all of those in agriculture.
Oh, so you're actually moving in?
That is the plan, yes, we will. We do have an office penciled in for us at TFGA's new head office in Longford when it's completed.
And also sort of sharing knowledge, etc.
Yeah, well, Primary Employers Tasmania will stay focused on employment and workforce issues and feed through any issues and relevant information and any areas where government can assist through with TFGA, and we'll together tackle those issues.
Ian Saw from the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association. So how did this come about? Was there sort of demand from farmers?
Look, I think, yes, look, it was part by demand, but it was obviously really obvious that there were two organisations, and TFGA was dealing with HR type issues, PET were doing that as well. TFGA felt that, there was an opportunity to value add the proposition to its members, and why not combine resources? You get a better service, you get a cheaper service, you get a local service. So that's why we did it. It was just a no-brainer.
So do you share funding? How does it work in that sort of sense?
Well, at the moment, we've got a service provider that we keep on a retainer, and then so much an hour on that. We're finishing with that service, and we'll be doing exactly the same with PET, but we've signed an MOU, and we will be closer because we will be sharing resources. So it's just value-adding, and I think we've spoken before, Fiona, that the agricultural sector in Tasmania, it's built by silos. We've got to start knocking those silos down so everyone starts talking, working together for a better services. And this is just the first step in that process.
I noticed the Dairy Outlook came out this week, and in that, workplace issues and workforce issues are still holding some people back. It's still a big issue for farmers. You're still hearing about that?
Oh, well, look, it's a huge issue, and whether it's the dairy issue, whether it's the housing, whether it's attracting and retaining the right skilled people, whether that's in the dairy industry, it doesn't matter, the highly intensive areas, whether it's shearing issue, it doesn't matter. But again, that PET and TFGA combining on that, we're going to have much more clout in being able to share resources to be able to help resolve those issues.
Ben Grubb from the Primary Employers Tasmania, you're still getting farmers contacting you about staffing, about the workforce?
Oh, absolutely, Fiona. Everyone I speak to, it's the first, first comment they make, an issue that's top of mind at the moment. Everyone is struggling to find workers, whether they be skilled or unskilled. And so we've all just got to do our part to improve the workforce and try and attract them. I think it is slowly unlocking, but it is a real challenge out there at the moment.
So backpackers are coming back or are back. You've got more migrants coming in. Are they coming further into the rural industries?
Yes, is the answer. And we are seeing a lot more. There has been an unlocking of the PALM scheme, Pacific Island scheme. And Tasmania seems to be punching well above its weight in being able to attract and have them elect to come to Tasmania, which is great. And I think the backpackers' numbers are increasing, but just not what they were pre-COVID. Just back to your question, Fiona, about funding and whether we're pulling forces. I need to make the point that Primary Employers Tasmania is a registered organisation with the Fair Work Commission. So under the registered organisation rules, we are required to have our own membership and our own rules of association, and under strict governance and compliance with them. There are many members within TFGA that don't require, they want to support TFGA as a voice in agriculture, but don't require advice on employment-related matters. So that, if that answers the question,
collaboration rather than
we do need
absorption.
To have our own membership. And it's how it was 20 years ago when it was the TFGA Industrial Association. They still had their own members paying membership fee. And that's how it's going to work moving forward.
Okay, Ian Saw from the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association. The organisation seems to have really come out the other side, or is coming out the other side of a bit of a quieter time, a membership down a bit. Are you seeing more people join up?
Fiona, yeah, the answer is yes. And the board of TFGA over the last few years have been absolutely laser focused on being strategic. So we've got our strategic plan. It's the first time for a long time. We've got a communications plan. We're developing a membership engagement strategy. We want to be seen, heard, and acted upon. So that's what we're doing. We've also got a focus of attracting younger members. So we feel that, you know, unless you get those younger farmers, the new and emerging farmers, because in 20 years, people like myself and Ben, we're either going to be retired or dead. And so if we don't have those younger farmers coming through in a good transition, there'll be nowhere there. So that's TFGA's focus, and one of the focuses of our strategic plan is collaboration. And this is part of the collaboration, and younger farmers keep on saying to us, you know, we need more collaboration. We want the whole ag food chain to be talking to one another. So this is a part of it.
Fiona, that is a really key point.
Tasmania needs to have a united voice on this the largest issue we face, employment and workplace relations. We need to stop duplicating resources, churning through volunteers' time, or talking about the same topics across multiple meetings. We need
so join up and have one voice pretty much on some of these issues.
We need to lobby together because our industry deserves a united voice, and PET and TFGA look forward to growing a strong Tasmanian agricultural industry together.
President of Primary Employers Tasmania, Ben Grubb, and the President of the TFGA, Ian Saw, talking there to Fiona Breen about their closer working relationship to try and resolve issues like labour shortages in the Tasmanian farm sectors. Well, speaking of jobs, several industries have united this week to attack the federal government's proposed same job, same pay law.
The federal government wants to introduce a new law called Same Job, Same Pay. It doesn't mean equal pay for men and women. It means if you work hard because you want better pay, by law, you can't be paid any more than someone who barely works at all. Let's find a better way, because Same Job, Same Pay takes your reward for your hard work away.
It's a multi-million dollar attack campaign which has the backing of groups such as National Farmers Federation, the Business Council of Australia, Master Builders and the Minerals Council. Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers says the concerns raised by the group are not correct.
This isn't about stopping businesses rewarding experience. It's about making sure that workers are eligible for the pay and conditions that the employers have agreed with their workforces. It's about closing loopholes to make sure that labour hire, for example, or casual workers or gig workers are used in the way that they're intended.
So what does it all mean for farmers? It's a question Matt Brand put to Tony Ma, CEO of the National Farmers Federation.
Yeah, look, at the top of the page, it's really unfair, unreasonable and actually unpractical or unrealistic on how this same job, same pay policy might roll out. It really doesn't recognise the flexibility that's required in the agriculture/farming sector. And, you know, worst case scenario, what it'll mean is agriculture will still struggle in terms of attracting people to the industry. So it could make them uncompetitive. It's more red tape for farmers. So, you know, it's unworkable on a number of levels, Matt.
For a territory mango farmer, for example, can you give us a sense on what this would look like?
Sure. So for a worst case scenario, a mango business up in the territory might have had someone working in the business for 2 or 3 years, come harvest season, they get some short-term contractors in. In its worst-case scenario, those contractors that have been in the business for, you know, 6 minutes or 6 hours might have to be paid for someone that's been in the business for 6 years. Now, everyone knows that that's unfair, doesn't recognise expertise, initiative, experience, and often these contractors are being paid wages, you know, that recognise they're in the business for a short period of time. So it really just doesn't recognise the realities of business either in the territory or across Australia.
If you've got a worker who's been in the business for 6 years plus and is a wonderful worker, these proposed laws wouldn't stop a business from paying that person more though, would it?
It definitely wouldn't. And most businesses, if you've got a good worker and they've been with you for a number of years, chances are they're being paid above award wages, getting better conditions because obviously the farm business wants to look after that person. They're an asset to the business. So it doesn't stop them from, you know, providing them from way above award wages. And that would be our expectation anyway. But what this same job, same pay scheme might do is that for someone that's come into the business for 6 weeks or even 6 months, it might mean that that person gets the same as the person that's been in the business for 6 years or 10 years. And it means extra requirements on farmers. So they'd have to actually go through that labour hire contractor, work out exactly what's being paid, weigh it up with what the other experienced employees being paid. It really takes the flexibility and the management away from the farm business and doesn't recognise, you know, loyalty, experience, skills, initiative, hard work, all of these things that farmers really value.
Just going off what the Treasurer Jim Chalmers said, this is about making sure, say, a seasonal worker is eligible for the same pay and the same conditions. Now, why shouldn't that happen?
Well, they should get a fair day's wage for a fair day's pay. And, you know, there's a range of provisions that might allow for that. What, in its worst case scenario, it automatically means that, you know, a seasonal worker or a short-term casual worker might get the same as a permanent employee that has been with you for a whole, you know, longer period of time. And you can't just manufacture and you know, click your fingers and pretend that all workers have got the same ability. They haven't. And this, you know, is a really blunt instrument. And that's what we're saying to the government is, you know, listen to the businesses, listen to industry. We want to make sure that we've got the right conditions to attract and keep people in the industry.
That's Tony Maher, CEO of the National Farmers Federation, talking now to Matt Brand about the Same Job, Same Pay campaign. Well, talking jobs, a farmer in the Riverina, Damien and Carissa Schneider, are using their sense of humour and social media to find a much-needed farm operations assistant. Cara Jeffrey caught up with them at their Culcan property to find out more.
G'day, I'm Damien and I'm 47 years old and I'm looking for a worker. I've already got the wife, that's taken care of.
So what type of worker are you after?
So someone that can sort of do most things with farming side of it, but adaptability is the key, and accept that farming is always varied and got to change with the times, I suppose, with it all.
What happens on your farm at Culcan?
Well, we're a dryland cropping farm with sheep and a few cattle, but the primary part is the dryland cropping side of it.
You've taken a bit of a different approach to try and recruit some staff at the moment. So I guess, yeah, tell us a bit about what you're doing to try and get some workers.
Like, it is hard for everyone at the moment with getting staff, but I think you've got to stand out from the pack a little bit. So add a bit of fun to it, which is what we want anyway. So if we're going to attract that kind of person by coming across as fun, and they hopefully will be sort of a fun working person, that's why we've taken that approach.
And how long have you been trying to recruit to get workers here?
Oh, only a couple of days. Our previous staff members just left to start his own business, so we finally got out and put our ad out just the other night, just to stir the pot a bit, I suppose.
You've put it on social media, so what's the response been like so far?
It's been really good so far, yeah. We've had, I haven't really counted, but just direct messages, I think I'm up to 40 or 50, and then a few other emails as well. So yeah, it's been pretty good and rapid, and a lot of shares and likes and all that kind of jazz, but we'll see what happens out of that, I suppose.
When things do go viral and people start applying for it, how do you sift through the applications?
I think it's really important that it aligns with our values. So they're fun, passion and innovation. And so we want someone that, through answering the question, shows that. And then we've got our key selection criteria. So they need some experience. Of course, they don't have to have done it all before, but some experience and just that they're showing initiative. We want to know a bit about them as well, what they like to do in their own time, just so we make sure that the character fits, because we think that's really important.
With people coming into agriculture, are you hoping to get someone that's quite experienced or out of uni? What type of person do you think would be a good fit?
I think reasonable experience, but we're very willing to get right into it and to pick up things fast is probably so helpful, I suppose.
Yeah, initiative's a big thing. So if they're lacking in some experience, but they've got that initiative and willingness to learn and ask questions when needed, that's really important to us. We love to communicate and we want someone that's willing to do the same.
None of us are great at everything. We just want to have, we can spread it between different skill sets of different people.
And in this area, there's a mixture of livestock and cropping enterprises. Are you hearing that there is a skills shortage and a labour shortage across all those farming enterprises in your area?
Yeah, we are. It's like people have just evaporated. In every industry, transport, livestock, yeah, farming in general, building, or we're trying to build a house. So, but yeah, I think if you want the job, if someone wants the right job and you can attract the right person, then it shouldn't be that hard to keep them.
You're busy with sowing at the moment, nearly wrapped that up. So is it a case of urgency that you'll hire someone straight away, or you're ready to wait for the right person?
Definitely willing to wait for the right person. I think we've learnt from the past in hiring an agency, and it doesn't always work out so well. So we're really passionate about getting someone that fits our workplace culture.
And do you need to make it quite lucrative to get people to move for a job? Do you need to offer a house and a pretty decent salary?
It can be, yeah, depending on location, that can vary extremely. A lot of friends that are further out back, so they have more of an isolation, which is harder for them to attract staff. Yeah, the wages everywhere are through the roof. I think also another side of it is the environment that you're working in, a fun environment. We've all probably had crap jobs that really put you down in the dumps and you spend more time looking at the clock. I think even have a bit of fun while you're doing it, it takes that edge off it. And flexibility is probably the biggest key in any job now. Like, I don't like to miss out any kids' activities, sporting activities, so time off to get to that or appointments is strictly sort of almost mandatory. We're trying to make it so that they don't miss out on life instead of thinking they have to work every day.
And I guess to sum it up, why would someone want to come and work for the Schneiders?
Someone I think that's striving to see improvement in farming. So we're really passionate on innovative farming and trying to keep up with the times with that. So trying new things and testing out the boundaries, I guess, and always striving to improve our productivity. So someone that's passionate about seeing improvement, I think, is what we're looking for.
That was Culcan Farmers, Damien and Carissa Schneider speaking there too. Cara Jeffrey, farmer, wants a worker. Coming up on the Country Hour, visit to a busy northwest Tasmanian farm, and we'll check the latest on the weather. A little bit of rain about, but more on the way. First up, the new news headlines with Ellie Ward.
Thanks, Tony. Economists are split over whether the Reserve Bank will raise interest rates at today's monthly board meeting. Since the record lows of early last year, the RBA board has increased the official cash rate 11 times to its current figure of 3.85%. Premier Jeremy Rockliffe says a final vote on whether a Hobart AFL stadium will be built is not expected to take place until early 2025 in the lead up to the next state election. The federal opposition's rejecting claims of pork barrelling after another scathing assessment of its management of grants programs while in government. And Hollywood actors have voted to go on strike if they don't agree on a new contract with major studios, streamers and production companies by the end of the month. They're all members of a major union which represents over 160,000 screen actors, broadcast journalists, announcers, hosts and stunt performers. More news at 1.
Time now to check the latest on the weather. Matthew Thomas joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Matthew.
G'day, Tony.
Bit of rainfall about.
Yes, look, 2:09 a.m, the highest amounts were about the north of the state, in particular the northeast ranges, upper east coast, and up against the western tiers. And they're the locations that will probably pick up the bulk of the rainfall, in particular the western tiers and the northeast ranges in coming days. But we've had 7 millimetres at Lake Mackenzie and Mount Barrow and St Patrick's Head, 6 millimetres at Fisher River, 5 millimetres at Grey and also at Smithton and at Iris River. Now, we did, since 9 a.m, we've seen just some showers also about those locations in the north, but also a little band that did push through the south through the middle part of the morning, and that looks to have cleared up now. So for the remainder of today, we'll just see some showers continue about the north, most likely about the ranges. And in terms of amounts, we're probably looking at fairly similar. We might see 5 to 10 millimetres possible about some of those more elevated locations, but generally less than 5 millimetres about the lower lying areas. Really just some scattered showers. Today is very much a building day in terms of the any precipitation, and we'll see fairly similar into tomorrow. So high pressure system over the Tasman Sea, just directing a northeast stream across Tasmania, so the locations that will pick up the best rainfall, the upper east coast, northeast ranges, and the northwest coast and up against the western tiers. Now, Wednesday afternoon, we see the situation change and we see some moisture push in from the northwest, and so we will see a rain band push in over King Island during the afternoon and move on to the northwest coast by early evening, and then that will increase about the northwest we'll see around 10 to 20 millimetres about the northwest in those last 6 hours of the night, 30 to 40 millimetres possible about the ranges and up against the western tiers as well. And then with that that rain band to move across the whole of the state on Thursday morning, as a front moves across, we'll see a further 10 to 20 millimetres about the north, a 30 to 50 millimetres possible about the ranges, and that does include the northeast ranges. So all up, we're looking at around 20 to 40 millimetres about the north in about an 18-hour period, around 40 to 100 millimetres about the northwest ranges and up against the western tiers, and 30 to 50 millimetres about the northeast ranges, around 5 to 15 millimetres about the west of the state on Thursday, and we'll see around 2 to 10 millimetres about the southeast and the lower east. But that that rain band will have cleared to the east of the state by about midday on Thursday, and we'll just end up with some showers across the state embedded in a northwesterly stream, with the scattered showers mainly about the north and the west of the state, but considerably less in terms of rainfall totals later on Thursday. And then we've got another front to cross on Friday, and that's going to bring a cooler westerly stream to Tasmania. In terms of the rainfall on Friday, we're looking at the bulk of the rainfall really being about the west of the state, with about 15 to 25 millimetres about the west. But as that front does cross, we will see amounts sort of the showers extend to central and eastern parts, probably only the sort of 0 to 2 millimetres about the east, but we could see 1 to 5 millimetres about central parts, and even into the southeast as that next front does cross on Friday. There'll be some small hail possible with that. A ridge of high pressure to build to the north on Saturday, extending a ridge across Tasmania, just contracting those showers back to the west and easing. So in terms of warnings that we have, we've got strong wind warning for today for western coastal waters, low rocky point to Sandy Cape, and for northeastern coastal waters from the northern tip of Flinders Island to St Helens Point. Into tomorrow, the strong wind warnings do extend, and they're for western coastal waters from low rocky point to Stanley, and for eastern coastal waters from the northern tip of Flinders Island to Wineglass Bay, and also southeastern coastal waters from Tasman Island to southeast Cape.
And the coastal waters and swell.
So for the remainder of today, north to north easterly winds of 10 to 20 knots, but reaching 20 to 30 knots about the central west and east of Flinders Island, mostly offshore though. Into tomorrow, we'll start off with the north to north easterly winds of 10 to 20 knots, but they will increase to 15 to 25 knots during the afternoon, and reaching up to 30 knots about western and eastern waters in the late evening as that cold front is approaching. In terms of swells around the west and the south, a southwesterly of 1 to 2 metres, continuing into tomorrow. About the north, we'll have a westerly below 1 metre, and about the east, a southerly of 0.5 to 1.5 metres, but a northeasterly building today up to 1 metre and reaching 1 to 1.5 metres tomorrow. The wave rider buoy at Cape Sorrel is currently showing a significant wave of 1.4 metres. A maximum wave of is not displaying, but and we've got a 13-second period. The wave rider buoy at Maria Island is showing a significant wave of 1.6 metres, so higher on the east coast actually today, and a maximum wave of 2.3 metres.
Beauty. Thank you, Matthew.
Have a great day.
You too. Matthew Thomas from the Bureau.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Take you to a very busy northwest Tasmanian farm in just a moment. But Australia will be hit by the bird flu outbreak that is spreading to animals around the world. Now, that's according to a global health expert in the UK, which has been struggling through an outbreak since October 21. Professor Davy Schreeder is the chair of global public health at the University of Edinburgh and has been sounding the alarm in the UK about the potential risks to human health. Fiona Broom has more.
There are hundreds of known strains of HPAI, that's highly pathogenic avian influenza. but only four HPAI strains have been shown to cause infections in humans, and one of them is spreading across the world. That's H5N1. While there's no recorded human-to-human transmission of H5N1, it has jumped from wild birds to poultry, other animals such as seals and native wild dogs, and some people have caught it through contact with infected animals. The UK's poultry industry has been hard hit by a two-year H5N1 outbreak. I asked Professor Sridhar if the impacts of the bird flu outbreak have gone beyond the poultry industry.
Well, I think we're seeing wider spread because we've seen wild bird populations affected and quite a number of birds dying of this, as well as the poultry industry. I mean, H5N1 has almost a 100% fatality rate in chickens. And so this means that even if one bird identified as being ill, the whole flock quickly is trying to be contained, which means killing off the birds and making sure it doesn't spread to other farms or other parts of a farm. So it's quite a serious issue right now within the world of poultry, within the world of wild birds, but it still yet hasn't gone into the world of human health. And that's kind of the interface I'm looking at.
Could you speak just a little bit about some of the control measures that have been put in place? I understand that mandatory housing measures for poultry and captive birds were in place across parts of the UK, but that was recently lifted.
Last November, turkeys, chickens, other birds were put into what was almost like an indoor lockdown, where they were mandated to stay indoors. And this was to protect them from the wild bird population, for example, ducks. It seems like this virus is endemic in ducks. And so if they fly by, they defecate, one of the animals on the farm gets ill, this was seen as a major risk. So birds are put into immediate indoor lockdown, which of course carries its own risks for bacterial infections, for antimicrobial resistance. And so in a way, it tried to manage this problem, but creates other problems at the same time.
Does the UK vaccinate poultry against bird flu strains?
Right now, it does not. They are discussing starting this, as well as actually starting trials of human vaccines for this, in case it would ever spread into infecting humans in an easy way. And so this is now being debated, and many countries are changing their policies towards starting to vaccinate birds, but for a long time, that just wasn't the case. It wasn't seen as a priority.
The scientific understanding at this stage about COVID-19 is that it emerged from an animal source. How concerned are you about the possibility of human transmission of this H5N1 strain of bird flu?
I think it's incredibly concerning because we're seeing signals from all parts of the world. It's not like COVID, which emerged from Wuhan in China. This is happening in Peru, Japan, across Britain, Scotland, the United States. So we are seeing global signals of a virus that has become more infectious in wild birds that is affecting poultry industry across the world, but now also humans becoming infected more randomly and seldomly, or enough seeing a pattern of, oh, okay, something is, this has been a step change in infectiousness. It still cannot spread human to human, which is the crucial change it would need to become a pandemic. And there are three sets of genetic mutations it would have to do to reach that point. It's already had one set of genetic mutations, so there's two more to go. But in a way, do we want to wait and watch and see who does it do this, or do we get ahead of it and prepare? Well, if it does, what are the ways that we contain this quickly or move to mitigate the harm it could cause?
Across poultry industries in Australia, there's a feeling that it's not going to turn up here, H5N1. What's your reaction to that? Do you think that that's complacent? Do you think that people in Australia should be more alert or more concerned?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, you should be looking at what's happened in Britain, what's happened now, even in Brazil. You know, Brazil has just had its first cases of H5N1. In birth and now trying to kind of go into an animal health emergency to try to manage this. We're seeing this appear everywhere. So it is likely, especially with seasonal migration of birds and, you know, movement of animals, that we will see it appearing.
Professor Davy Sridhar, the University of Edinburgh Chair of Global Public Health, talking there to Fiona Broom about the prospect of bird flu coming to Australia. Well, you often run into those amazing people that seem to have lived 1,000 different lives. Phil and Ange Glover have been shearers, young apprentices, dairy farmers, security guards, news agents. There's not a lot they haven't tried, and they're not afraid of taking a risk. They've ended up on a farm in the shadows of Mount Roland in the northwest, where they now run one of Tasmania's biggest free-range chicken farms, a few beef cattle, and an award-winning wedding business where couples can get married in the paddock and have a reception in a rustic barn filled with fairy lights.
I'm Phil Glover from Mount Roland Free Range and Carina Farm.
Hi, I'm Angela. I'm obviously the partner of Phil.
I want to start at the beginning for both of you.
Where did your farming journey begin?
For me, farming began when I was 5 years old and Dad went to King Island to share farm dairy cows and was over there for 5 years, and then we came back to Tasmania, to the northwest. Then I started working on farms as a farm labourer when I left school and learned to shear and had seven seasons of professional shearer until the downturn in the wool industry, and then we started looking for employment elsewhere, and I got a job at Lacrim at Smithton milking cows, and that was the beginning of our actual proper journey to get our own farm. We worked as myself and Angela worked as labourers on dairy farms for a couple of years, and they proceeded to rear calves and build a herd of cows, and in 7 years we owned 500 dairy cows, and at the end of which we sold most of the cows and bought the small farm which we got at Sheffield. Yeah, it was just a hobby farm for a while. We did some other things for a while. We was looking for another business, and we was rearing purebred poultry as a bit of a sideline, selling to the backyard layer market, and we went to buy some young birds off a free-range egg farm at Forth that was closing down at the time. We got talking to the guy there, and he was saying how it was going really good and a sort of an up-and-coming thing, and we made a few more inquiries at the DPI and another egg producer, and his sort of take on things was the same, that there was a huge demand and there wasn't enough people doing it to supply the demand. So we started off with 350 layers 11 years ago, and now we have 3,000. And it's, yeah, we haven't looked back at that. And 4 years ago, we started our own herd of cows, and we've just been grading up from dairy cross animals to hoping to get to a more straighter line of Speckle Park breeding cows.
What about you, Ange? Where did farming start for you?
Basically, when I met Phil, really. I was a little bit of a town person, so yeah. Met Phil and he sort of taught me all about farming, and it was a new experience for me. So yeah, it was great. It was so totally what I was not used to.
So the two of you started out share farming in Circular
Head. That's correct, yeah.
And eventually you worked for a corporation?
Yeah, the last 3 years we were share farm. We 50-50 share farm with what was called TasAgden, which was a New Zealand corporation which bought Woolnorf at the time, and I think they had 12 or 13 farms outside Woolnorf.
And at some point, something changed for the two of you. You didn't want to do this model anymore, which is really common in Circular Head. And a lot of people, you know, it suits a lot of people, but it didn't suit the two of you. What happened?
Well, we got to a stage where the farm was on. We couldn't grow anymore on that, so I was looking at probably having to step up, and the options at the time were probably step up to a 1,000-cow farm at Woolnorf, which wasn't really what we wanted to do. We wanted to be more independent. So it was in our mind that we'd try and lease a farm or sell our cows and buy another farm. A small farm come up. We milked cows there for 7 or 8 years, and it got to the stage it wasn't big enough to be viable anymore. And we had a couple of runoff blocks we used to lease, and then the tree farms come in and took them over. So we just said, well, this is not viable anymore. So we sold our cows and changed over to beef, and then went into adjustment, and we done a few other things for a while. Yeah,
that seems to be a problem that you faced a few times in your life. It wasn't big enough. You'd have to become profitable. You have to expand.
Yeah, grow. Yeah.
But the farm you're on now is 150 acres, if I remember correctly.
Thereabouts. Yeah, that's the total of the two places, yeah.
And it's far more profitable than it ever was
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
What's Definitely. Been the secret? What's changed?
I think the worldwide change in like what consumers want, like, obviously people want to know where their food come from, and at the time it was right for us to move, you know, when we started the free range eggs. Plus we're a term that's used is called layering, where we're doing well more than one thing on that land. Like if we was just a standalone running beef, it wouldn't be viable, or sheep, or you know, once again, if it was milking cows, it wouldn't be viable. But by having the chickens, the eggs, the income from the eggs, the beef, and then we've also got the B&Bs and the barn, which we do weddings in and have some other things, we've diversified. So that's something I learnt when I was shearing. I used to shear on a lot of crop farms, and during the 80s and that, the crop farms seemed to not, in the 90s, didn't seem to go through the ups and downs quite the same you've seen with the dairy. But the big thing that stood out to me was they were diversified. You know, nearly every crop farm grew multiple crops, and they had beef and they had sheep, so they're quite diversified compared to a dairy farm.
Speaking of diversity, one of the newer arms of the business is the accommodation, the tourism side, which is kind of your realm, Ange.
Yeah. A few years ago, we just decided we was actually thinking about it, whether we take on Carinya next door, which obviously consists of two B&Bs at the time. I could see the potential in what we could achieve, possibly. I like to think outside the box. I like to be very creative. So I said to Phil, I've got an idea, and he cringes every time I say that.
More money. Here we go.
Pretty well. So obviously from there, we cracked a few numbers and we obviously purchased the farm. And so obviously we've taken this on and I suppose updated the B&Bs a little bit and turned the old homestead there into a B&B as well. So enables us to cater for 14 people total to stay at our B&Bs. And then the barn, obviously, we seen that and, yeah, that sort of sent me into a whirl spin. Obviously, I could see the creativity there and what we could do to the old barn.
Not many people look at a rundown old barn and think, wow.
Yeah, it's just got lots of character. And I just thought, well, I'd love to turn this into a wedding venue. And that's where it all started. So then the challenge was there and obviously we've poured our hearts and souls into it, created this magic. They come here and they're pretty blown away with what we've created, I guess.
So you've got this barn here, you've got the Airbnbs, you've got animals running around, poultry of all colours and sizes and shapes.
Yep.
Has that been a fairly big investment on your part?
Yeah, it has been, yeah. We had to borrow money to purchase the property, but we've done most of what we've done has been done through cash flow. We're pretty lucky that we owned our previous farm, so that was threehold. And the chicken business was so strong that even during COVID when we couldn't have any guests here, we still had a cash surplus that we could, once we paid our loan commitments off, we could put that into these projects. Yeah.
So you could still upgrade because really you opened just before COVID, which is not great time.
No, it was the worst.
That was a bit of a worry at the time. Yeah, because we went basically to zero income off this property. But once again, being diversified, that diversity gave us that opportunity that it worked out that at the time, like anything to do with chickens went through the roof. Like we sold 2,000 cold for aged layers in 10 days for $10 each, so that was a pretty big cash injection at the time when things were looking pretty good. And the demand for eggs, like we lost nearly 50% of our customers, which were restaurants and cafes, because of the COVID restrictions, they basically weren't trading. So that was like all of a sudden we looked like we lost half our egg sales and all our income from B&Bs. But within a few weeks, the demand for eggs through retail just went through the roof. So
So are you in the black with this place?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. So within 4 years and through a pandemic where everything shut down.
Yep.
Wow.
We like to turn a negative into a positive all the time. We'd never, ever give up.
If this was a standalone, just the Carinya Farm side of it with the barn and the B&Bs, even without the chickens being part of it, the income from the B&Bs, the barn and the cattle, or the percentage of cattle that this place would run, of the herd, it's, we're cash flow positive in that.
Wow. Mm. What's next for this little? What else? I don't know if you can jam anything more on this 150.
Of course, we can, can't we, Phil?
Yeah. I suppose some of it's probably a little bit more fine tuning now. It's
micromanagement.
One of the big things on the farm now. Our big drive is to get more trees on the farm because our farm's virtually got hardly any. It has now, but 3 years ago, it hardly had any trees on it. And we've all, from the day we come here, I've always wanted to put more trees in, but because of cash, finance issues, it was always put on the back burner. There's always something else that needs money, but now we're sort of in a more positive cash flow situation. We've got money to put trees in and fence them off and manage them. So and that's for the benefit of the animals more so, because it's we're very windy here, so it gives them shade and shelter from the wind.
Busy Northwest farmers Ange and Phil Glover talking to Meg Powell through their journey, starting with nothing to building up a huge chicken business and opening an award-winning wedding venue in the middle of the global pandemic. And talking about the pandemic, Sam Penny's online business, Cheese Therapy, kept many small-scale cheesemakers afloat during the bushfires and the pandemic by selling rescue packages of their cheese. Now, the extreme sportsman who attempted to swim the English Channel in winter has taken the plunge and launched his own range of handmade cheeses called Max and Tom.
7 years ago, I launched Cheese Therapy. The whole idea of it is promoting small artisan cheese makers right around the country. And I deliver cheese straight into people's homes wherever they are in the country. It's been an amazing journey.
But now, today...
I know, it's exciting. I'm launching my own cheese brand. It's called Max and Tom. And it's all about really supporting small local dairy farmers in particular, focusing on great quality, but also sustainability in the farming practices. And also, I really believe that cheese is the one thing that brings people together. It's a great community builder. And if I can use cheese to bring people together, that's just a wonderful thing.
So how did you turn from salesman to artisan cheesemaker?
Oh, look, I think one of the things about anything, it all comes down to what your core values are. I gave a TEDx talk in December down in Brisbane, all on why people should buy direct from artisan producers. And that's things like visiting farmers markets, going direct to their website, buying from the artisan producer, even visiting those roadside honesty stalls. And I just thought, I think I really should be doing this myself as well. And I think I need to just walk the talk, as they say. So that's why I've been working on Max and Tom for quite a few months. And here it is. Today is my big launch.
What is this beautiful round creation?
I love this thing. It's called a cultured butter. I call it coastal cultured. And it's a lot different to a normal butter in that the milk has been fermented for a little bit before it's churned into the butter. So it gives it a nice sourness. It's salted. It is, I guess, the creme de la creme of butter. It's something that you just don't find in shops these days. But I tell you what, it elevates your cooking. It elevates just simply whacking it on a cracker. It is unbelievable.
And what have you got in these eskies here?
Well, I've got a beautiful white mold cheese, a nice triple cream called Noosa White. My hard cheese is a northern Italian style hard cheese called Moffat Sand. Beautiful blue, which is Gorgonzola style. That's called Budrum Blue. And then I've got a beautiful wash rind, a nice orange glowing cheese, and that's called Pacific Sunrise. And it's all about, yeah, just being able to really focus on what the Sunshine Coast region is and highlighting the great produce that we have here.
Are you relying on existing cheesemakers to get this out, or have you started your own factory?
No, so I use the milk from Mulaney Dairies. I use a factory down on the Gold Coast to make the cheese for me because there's no suitable facility up here on the Sunshine Coast.
They're in demand, the ones that are there.
Oh, I know, exactly. And then hopefully getting it out through retailers. I'll be at Noosa Farmers Market every Sunday, and it's all about being part of that community again. One of the really disturbing things about the dairy industry in particular, but also a lot of other farming right around Australia, is that 1980, we had 22,000 dairy farms. Today, we've got less than 6,000. That consolidation and a lot of the big multinationals moving into Australia, taking over a lot of our farming, it's really disturbing. So when you buy direct from an artisan producer, what we're able to do is to make small batch farming more viable. And how great would it be if families could get back to owning a farm and actually making a living out of it just from their small plot? It'd be amazing.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but haven't you been an extreme sportsman in the past?
Maybe. I'm the only person in the world who's ever attempted to swim the English Channel in winter in December. That was cold. I ended up with hypothermia. I swam the English Channel, ice miles, and a whole range of other stupid things. Cheese is just part of the
safer.
Joy. So, I think safer. Yeah, it's... I think when you really follow your passion, it makes it part of your life, and it's just enjoyable. You know, I love doing stupid stuff in the sporting world, but also Max and Tom, it's something new, it's innovative. We've got some great new cheeses coming out, and just being able to launch a new brand that really is bright and vibrant and fun, and it's not taking itself too seriously.
Sam Penny, who doesn't take things too seriously there, the cheesemaker, speaking with Jennifer Nichols about his decision to become a cheesemaker after helping many cheesemakers during the pandemic by offering rescue packages of their cheese and sending it out online, helping lots of cheesemakers through Australia. I suppose... It's not like swimming the English Channel in winter. If you don't sell your cheese, you can always eat it, can't you? On our text line, Ash says, Tony, this campaign by the NFF is completely misdirected. None of the issues raised are the intention of the legislation. Thank you for that, Ash. 0438922936 is our text line number for future reference. And if you go to ABC Rural Online, you'll see that story about the prediction from ABARES, the forecast agricultural production to fall by 14% to reach $79 billion in the next financial year. And drier conditions and lower yield are expected to slash crop production by 34%. And exports forecast to be down by 17%. Fiona's done a great online story with all the details there for you on our ABC Rural page. That's our Country Hour for today. We will catch you after midday tomorrow.